We're going to get it done. I'd say within the next couple of months, it'll be complete, and they can go ahead and build.
President Trump says he foresees a speedy process on the construction of the King Cove Road. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, dead seabirds are washing up on Western Alaska beaches.
They're dying of starvation, but there might be other contributing factors.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
President Trump and Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke at the White House today. He boldly predicted the controversial King Cove Road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge will be finished soon. But it hasn't begun. Murkowski made a plea for bipartisanship, and Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports on a 2.5-minute exchange in the cabinet room between two people talking past each other.
It was one of those meetings with a lot of people gathered around a large table. In this case, it was the Republican members of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees. With cameras rolling, Trump asked Murkowski about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Senator, how's Anwar doing? Okay.
We are moving on Anwar.
Then he spoke about the King Cove Road. In January, his Interior Secretary agreed to exchange land in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge for the road corridor. But that's as far as it's gone. Conservation groups are suing, and the land exchange hasn't moved forward. Murkowski told Trump it's important to go through the process. Trump clearly has a speedier timetable in mind.
This is a road that was, I guess it's been, they've been trying to build it for 30 years. We're going to get it done very quickly. It's almost completed.
A second later, Trump seemed to acknowledge there is a pre-construction process.
We're going to get it done. I'd say within the next couple of months, it'll be complete, and they can go ahead and build.
The environmental review on the road hasn't begun, and on a controversial project like this, it can take a few years. Pleasantries out of the way, Murkowski spoke about the need for regular order. That's where Congress passes individual spending bills rather than just passing emergency measures to keep the government from shutting down.
But we have got to be able to work with our colleagues on the other side, sometimes as hard as that is. So thank you for encouraging us to do that, because I think that that makes a difference.
It's been a very terrific group of people to work with, I have to say that.
Our colleagues on the other side. She meant Democrats. Murkowski said they need to cooperate with Democrats to pass bills. Trump did not seem to be saying that he had worked well with Democrats. Several times during the meeting, he painted them as uncaring about America's security and obstructionist. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
State prosecutors have charged a former Alaska resident with nearly 150 felony counts for an alleged permanent fund dividend fraud scheme. An arrest warrant for 44-year-old Sheila Mary Rose McMahon was issued after last week's grand jury indictment, which includes 15 pages just listing the charges against her. But it's unclear where McMahon actually lives now. She was still on the loose as of today. McMahon is accused of making false statements on multiple PFD applications for 3 years' worth of dividends and theft of the money she allegedly received. According to an indictment, McMahon provided fake documents, including employment information from abitofblarney.com. Abitofblarney.com appears to be an online Irish gift shop. State records show McMahon registered it as a business with an address at a Midtown Anchorage apartment building. The website itself only lists locations in Atlanta, Georgia, and Dublin, Ireland. Prosecutors say fewer than 15 of the 71 applications McMahon filed were for real people, and the rest of the identities were either partially or wholly fabricated. She allegedly received more than $17,000 of the nearly $80,000 she tried to get from the permanent fund. A search is underway for a small airplane headed to McCarthy with two people on board. A pilot and his wife took off in a Piper PA-18 Super Cub. Their route took the airplane south of Fairbanks. The Alaska Air National Guard, in a release, says it launched a search Monday morning after a family member called the Rescue Coordination Center. The Guard says their crews were joined by four Civil Air Patrol aircraft, two Marine Corps aircraft, aircraft from the National Park Service, and volunteer pilots. Searching continued today. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new program seeks to get young girls excited about science and mountaineering.
There aren't as many role models to look up to these days just because of the history of those fields being mostly male-dominated.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Strong Hearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The Yukon Quest is upholding the censure of two-time past champion Hugh Neff, related to the death of one of his dogs in the 2018 race. In a written statement, the Yukon Quest says a panel consisting of a musher, a veterinarian, and a community member considered evidence presented by Neff and race officials during 2 days of hearings earlier this month. It says the panel concluded Neff did not provide, quote, clear and convincing evidence, end quote, to overturn a censure, which bans him from the 1,000-mile sled dog race for 2 years. Neff's dog, Boppy, died of aspiration pneumonia at a remote cabin before the Quest's halfway point in February. Neff later scratched from the race. A necropsy found that the dog was in poor health, suffering from stomach ulcers, intestinal inflammation, worms, skeletal muscle necrosis, severe weight loss, and muscle wasting. Neff, who could not be reached for comment today, has characterized the censure as a personal attack. It bans him from entering the Yukon Quest in 2019 and requires him to complete the shorter Quest 300 before entering the 1,000-mile race in the future. Neff, who is based out of Tok in recent years, won the Quest in 2012 and 2016. Seabirds have once again been found washed up on beaches in western Alaska. Since May, birds have been reported dead or behaving strangely in communities throughout the Bering Strait region, from Shishmaref to Unalakleet and on St. Lawrence Island. Large-scale die-offs of seabirds and other marine animals have been occurring around the state for several years, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants to know why. That takes the help of boots-on-the-ground partners across Alaska. Gay Sheffield is one of those partners. She's a marine biologist with Alaska Sea Grant in Nome, and she has helped coordinate the collection of dead birds. Sheffield says only one bird has been tested so far this year, a murre collected in Unalakleet in May.
The murre was tested for harmful algal blooms, tested for avian cholera, was tested for bird flu, and a full necropsy or little bird autopsy was done. And the result was that the bird had starved to death.
She says knowing that a bird ultimately didn't get enough food doesn't answer the larger question of why it died.
They're dying of starvation, but there might be other contributing factors.
Rob Kaler is a wildlife biologist at Wildlife Service's Migratory Bird Management Office in Anchorage. He's been monitoring the seabird die-offs statewide. Kaler says factors contributing to bird deaths could include neurotoxin poisoning from algal blooms, increased storminess, or shifts in the type of fish available to birds to eat. And he says many of the factors could be connected to warming sea surface temperatures off the coast of Alaska. Both Sheffield and Kaler underscore the importance of collecting more freshly dead birds. More samples mean more testing and more information that can be returned to communities where healthy seabirds mean food security.
We need to provide them with answers on whether these birds are safe to consume or not, whether their eggs are safe to consume.
Several birds were recently collected from Shishmaref and Gamble. Test results will be forthcoming. To report a dead seabird anywhere in the state, call the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Dead Seabird Hotline at 866-527-3358. The Alaska Volcano Observatory says lava has flowed into the crater at the top of an Aleutian Islands volcano. The circular lava flow was spotted Monday at Mount Cleveland. The flow measured about 260 feet in diameter. The U.S. Geological Survey says lava flowing over the mountain's active vent increased the possibility of a vent clearing explosion. The center raised the aviation warning code to watch level. The USGS says Cleveland volcano explosions typically produce relatively small volcanic ash clouds that dissipate within hours, but that significant ash emissions have occurred. The last detected explosive activity occurred May 4th. Cleveland Volcano is 940 miles southwest of Anchorage. Satellite monitoring also detected a possible steam emission that may be related to lava in the crater. The Army Corps of Engineers last fall halted cleanup of fuel-tainted soil near Birch Lake, about 60 miles south of Fairbanks. When workers uncovered buried junk that included barrels and with residues of a different contaminant, the banned pesticides DDT and chlordane. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Cleanup project manager Beth Astley says contractor workers discovered the junk while excavating soil contaminated by old leaky fuel storage tanks in an area that's now part of the Birch Lake State Recreation Site.
We ran into some trash, some buried metal, some drums that were empty. And when we got to some rusted out cans of insecticide that were labeled as containing DDT, we stopped.
Astley says Anchorage-based Bristol Environmental Remediation Services had to stop excavating the site because its contract called for removal of soil contaminated by fuel.
So we stopped, we sampled, and at that point, we decided to terminate the removal effort until we could determine the full extent of this buried debris that may contain pesticides.
The Birch Lake cleanup is one of several the Corps has conducted in recent years along the old Haines to Fairbanks pipeline, a 626-mile, 8-inch line built by the military in the 1950s and shut down in 1973. Astley and other Corps officials talked about the discovery of the toxins last week at a public meeting in Delta Junction.
The pesticide contamination is different because it requires us to ship soil out of the state for disposal because there's no permitted landfills in the state of Alaska that will accept this soil contaminated with pesticides.
Astley says workers found the debris about 3 feet below the surface in what appears to be a trash pit between where two large above-ground fuel storage tanks were located. She couldn't say exactly how much of the debris is buried at the site. She says a geophysical survey the Corps conducted last month may help agency officials estimate the amount of excavation that'll be needed to remove the junk, which includes some crushed 55-gallon drums that may have been used to mix the pesticides.
So we have a better idea now of the area that contains this buried waste, but we don't know how much of that might contain residue from pesticide drums that were crushed and disposed of.
Astley says the DDT and perhaps the chlordane were being used to kill mosquitoes. That was a common use for DDT from when it was developed in the 1940s until it was outlawed in 1972. It's categorized as a carcinogen, and tests have shown other health impacts. Chlordane was used as a pesticide from 1948 until it was banned in 1988 after tests linked it to neurological and reproductive system disorders. But Astley says the toxins shouldn't present a health threat now that the junk's been covered with a plastic liner and reburied with clean fill.
And so now the next step is to go back and to investigate the extent of this buried debris and to remove any hazardous debris or soil remaining at that site.
Astley says once that analysis is done, Corps officials will develop a new contract to remove the junk and contaminated soil. She says if all goes well, that work could be done in the summer of 2020. Astley's state counterpart agrees the junk won't threaten human health, both because it's been reburied and because it appears there were only small residual amounts of the pesticides in the crushed drums and cans.
This isn't something that's on the surface. This isn't something that if you were to be on site, you would encounter. So as far as an immediate threat to human health and the environment, that's not the case.
Danielle Duncan is a contaminated site program specialist with the State Department of Environmental Conservation, and she's worked with Astley on the cleanup projects. She says the Corps' tests showed the presence of pesticides in soil around the buried junk, but she thinks it's unlikely that it's seeped into the groundwater or the lake's surface water. And she says DEC will likely conduct tests to confirm that.
Well, that is on our radar, as is groundwater.
Astley says the Corps finished its cleanup of the Birch Lake site and another near Quartz Lake. She says Corps officials now plan to study a nearby and lesser known site near Tenderfoot Creek, just north of Shaw Creek, where the pipeline burst in 1971 and spewed fuel into the creek bed. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Alaska Aerospace Corporation has scheduled a launch for next month at its Kodiak facility. President and CEO Craig Campbell says a commercial company will conduct the launch sometime between July 14th and 20th. and the site will be closed for certain hours during those days.
The intention is that the rocket will launch on the first day, but if the weather's bad, if there's an equipment issue, it protects the next few days so that they can continue to work to launch the rocket within a specified window.
Campbell says there were a couple of previous launch attempts this year that were not completed, and he isn't able to share anything more about the operation due to a non-disclosure agreement. He says AAC, which has a contract with the Missile Defense Agency, is trying to build the number of commercial companies it contracts with.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare volunteer, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska's seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
It's not news that science has a gender problem. For years, there's been a persistent gap, with significantly more men going into science and engineering careers than women. One program called Girls on Ice connects high school girls with both science and mountaineering, another space that's historically been dominated by men, by taking them out for a week to explore a glacier with an all-female team of scientists and mountaineers. Ravenna Koenig from Alaska's Energy Desk hiked with the women out to Golcana Glacier in the eastern Alaska Range and has this report.
Mountain guide Mia Toholke is standing at the start of the Golcana Glacier Trail, surveying a group of 16 and 17-year-old girls as they struggle to pull on mountaineering boots and gaiters.
Oh! Like I said, in a couple hours, we're going to have to undo all of this anyway.
Oh, my freaking God.
Because we're going to have to step in that lovely warm river.
Some of these girls are already pretty familiar with the outdoors. But others have never hiked up a glacier, spent a night camping in the wilderness, or crossed a freezing river with a pack on their back.
And we don't like have towels to dry our feet either.
No, I know, but we're gonna air dry.
Now, they're about to spend a week on Golcana Glacier with Toholke.
I like to suffer a little bit, and I like to show that suffering can be okay.
Toholke and a group of scientists will spend the week teaching the girls wilderness skills, glacier science 101, how to do field research, and all the different ways you can make observations about the natural world, whether that's as a mountaineer, a scientist, or an artist.
Something we're going to continue talking about for the rest of the week is what is sort of the line between art and science? When is that blurred? Should they be, you know, these separate things, are they the same?
Aurora Roth is a glaciologist.
I absolutely love ice. I'm an ice nerd.
Some of the girls participating in this program already know they want to go into science. Everything from zoology to astrophysics to nursing.
I'm Lauren Smith. I'm from Portland, Oregon. My absolute dream would be to write about science in a way where it would be accessible for everyone.
Even though there are more women in the sciences than there used to be, instructor Emily Sinkler says that the relatively low number of women in science and mountaineering makes it harder for some girls to see themselves getting involved.
There aren't as many role models to look up to these days just because of the history of those fields being mostly male-dominated.
And so part of the goal of Girls on Ice is just to give girls exposure to women who scale mountains and do science, and basically show that it's an option.
We want to give them extra confidence and experience in the outdoors and in science to see if those are the directions that they might want to go potentially.
Beyond that, instructors hope that spending a week braving the Alaskan wilderness with an all-female group will inspire the girls to take on whatever challenges they encounter in their lives. Jessica Mejia is a glaciologist and one of the organizers of the Golcana trip.
I think it's just so empowering just that as women alone, we can do this. We can do great science. We could be on a glacier by ourselves. We could, you know, we could do anything.
Even, as so many of the girls were worried about, sidestep with a heavy pack on your back through a tumbling glacial river so cold it gives you brain freeze.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh!
From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Before the current popularity of looking for your ancestors through websites that offer DNA testing, there was a large scientific undertaking called the Human Genome Project. It started in the mid-90s and wrapped up in 2003. It was controversial in some communities because people feared it was an effort to steal their genetic information, or worse, create bio-targeted weapons. Dr. Eric Green, director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health, says those fears were unfounded. He says the project's signature accomplishment was reading out the 3 billion letters that make up the human genome. Dr. Green gave the keynote address at the South Central Foundation conference in Anchorage last week. He spoke with Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend and said the sequencing was successfully completed in 2003. But he says that was really just the start of understanding the blueprint of human DNA.
We're interested in each of our genome sequences, and in particular, we're interested in how we differ. Turns out that you and I, if we lined up our genome sequences, we differ about 1 out of 1,000 letters, or we're 99.9% identical. But while we are very different in many things about our health, our well-being, features, et cetera, and so it's all of those differences, or many of those different, most of those differences are coded in that 0.1% of the letters that are different between it. And so the real interest is not so much how are we the same. The real interest is how are we different? And in particular, I can tell you as a physician, and in particular working at the National Institutes of Health with a health focus, we're particularly interested in which are the differences amongst people's genomes that play a role in their health and have an influence on human disease.
So talk a little bit about that. What was learned or what is still being learned from this undertaking, and how does it help in the understanding of disease?
So the journey to understand the human genome began 15 years ago when we had in front of us the first sequence. That journey is far from complete by any means, but we've made a lot of progress in 15 years. Most importantly, we've gotten extremely good at being able to read out genomes now, much more cost-effectively. I'll give you some numbers. That first human genome sequence generated by the Human Genome Project cost something like $1 billion. Just a rounded number, about $1 billion. Now the cost for sequencing a human genome is down to just a little over $1,000. It's a million-fold reduction. What that has allowed us to do is to go out and sequence literally hundreds of thousands of people's genomes and catalog all the differences.
And is it at its most basic than the trying to better understand what, I guess, normal human biology is probably inadequate, but just a deeper understanding of individual biology?
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, when genomics is being used in research to understand disease, it's giving us brilliant insights about what's broken when you have a patient with hypertension, what's broken in the pathways that lead to diabetes. But when we talk about genomic medicine, that's not just biological knowledge, that's knowledge about an individual. So much of our differential drug response is scripted in our genomes, in subtle little spelling differences in what turn out to be the pathways that metabolize drugs. And so either there's certain medications that you're better or worse to take, or at least the dosage might be higher or lower depending on. So there's a big word for this, pharmacogenomics. It's just pharmacology and genomics. It is not making new medicines for each patient, but rather picking the best medication off of a list of possible medications and using that or adjusting the dose based on that. That's not hypothetical. That's here and now for a handful of medications. I predict that list will grow because we're learning more and more every day about the genomic variants that influence drug metabolism and how that influences the best choice of medications. That's here and now.
I'm so glad you raised that because I wanted to ask a question about a friend of mine who is going through treatment for cancer and has transitioned from chemo and radiation to immunotherapy. Is that part of what you're talking about? Is immunotherapy informed by genomics?
It can be informed by genomics. I mean, immunotherapy is slightly different in that it's basically harnessing your body's natural immune tools to basically go after cancer, and there's some spectacular, exciting advances. But if you take a step back from that, what we're starting to use genomics for is to take each patient's individual cancer, and instead of just trial and error, we'll try this, what we're hoping will come out of it is by doing genomic studies of that tumor from that patient, better knowing up front, based on the unique genomic changes that have taken place, whether this therapeutic option or that therapeutic option or a third therapy is the most effective way to go.
Dr. Green, you're giving the keynote address at the annual South Central Foundation's conference on the NuCA system of care. What do you plan to focus on in your talk?
So I think the overarching goal of my talk is to really just describe this journey. And actually, it's plural. It's journeys. It's this, it's my professional journey of sort of going from a freshly minted physician scientist and then training in pathology and then having this ability to walk down this path of genomics, which has turned out to be a remarkable adventure. But then the journey of genomics and seeing it go from something that once upon a time had some skepticism around it to now, in a very short period of time, delivering on its first major promise, the Human Genome Project, and now having the Herculean task of trying to change something as complicated as medical care.
Dr. Eric Green is the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media, and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zoe Gruskin in Nome, Tim Ellis and Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Lori Townsend in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. ACPE's education loan refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.